Birth, Volume 3, The Gathering, Chapter 41. The wide circles that made up the holding pattern of the Looking Glass High-Altitude Battlefield Observatory let the new Earth pass from their view over the horizon. The 936-hertz-based music blasted into the atmospheres of both worlds, but it was only compatible with the new Earth. The dark energy of the old Earth formed a turbulent and violent storm, not unlike a cold front capturing a warm, moist gulf formation. The result was a massive drop in barometric pressure, and the moisture being forced upward through columns of stratospheric air. The polar plasma, snapping back to the North Pole of the old Earth, would have made a bad day for flying. A very bad day. The flight crew was directed to turn south and head for the Denver airport. The vacant comm station on Looking Glass was manned with one sleepy tech sergeant who knew what he was doing. The discovery of numerous unauthorized transmissions from that computer provided evidence as to why the airman running it had disappeared from his post. He had received Shelley LaSalle's broadcast and sent it to his mother. His brother and his girlfriend living in Chattanooga, Tennessee. The airman's keynotes ended mid-sentence, just before the colonel had asked him for a battlefield update. The flight crew was under security watch to make sure the aircraft made it back to Denver safely without them also being translated to the new Earth. All communications were routed through the tech sergeant who had replaced the airman. With that exception, the aircraft was practicing radio silence. The space armada plunged with Stuka-like precision, using the upper atmosphere to perform a treacherous touch-and-go maneuver. Each ship released its entire payload of plasma weaponry in one pass due to the extreme risk in the flight plan. Tumbling out into space at nearly 20,000 miles an hour, they glowed white-hot and spit their retro-fuels like cats fighting a dozen cobras to regain control. The large carrier ships waited, superimposed on Lewis's screen like a video game, as the ships angled toward their geosynchronous orbit. The bombs took less than 3 minutes to begin detonating, blurring the harp-illuminated display like ungodly fireworks, expanding their electromagnetic pulse hundreds of miles in every direction, and vomiting conflagration to the docile surface of the planet. Every structure of stone and steel across Washington, D.C., Philadelphia, and half of the state of Virginia dissolved like dry grass before the destroying angels skipping across the sky like meteors. Hundreds and hundreds of explosions distorted the battlefield surveillance on the screen, making it impossible to imagine anyone or anything surviving the devastation. Like an unholy fractal, the genocidal display took each man on Looking Glass to a quiet place of disconnection from the millions who drew their last mortal breath, defenseless as grasshoppers in a raging brush fire. General Morlaix walked slowly, silently, with his hands folded together behind him to his forward cabin on the aircraft once the last ordnance was away. Riker had won. Yes, the ancient weapons had vaporized every living thing in the kill zone, but their souls were as safe as chicks under a hen's wing. Those helpless victims were not afraid. They didn't panic and tear one another apart to make the last ferry to safety or for the last jug of milk at the local market. This was never about victory. It was about burning a fine rented house to the ground after being evicted. Semyaza should be pleased at his yield from the creation of man on the earth for his master, the great prince of darkness. Only a few escaped with the planet, running back to its home like a dog struck by a car, to die. The vast majority of mankind had fallen to the multi-millennia battle plan to capture the souls who had dared risk their salvation to be born here. After all, it was the seed of Lucifer growing up next to the seed of Adam, who would kill a brother for his jacket or rape a woman simply because she was beautiful and weak and alone. It was they who filled the prisons of the world and hid themselves in priests' clothing while molesting the children of their parishes. The crafty semantics of the imams, the globalist elites, and the lawyers and the politicians were plain for anyone to see. But the dark secrets of the bankers and the generals who pillage the world for personal gain were always torn from the history books. The trails of blood and tears were covered over with roads and cities and football stadiums. The land stolen by corporate governments was called a monument or a park or a sanctuary, while secretly it was mortgaged or sold for billions to feed the administration's vacation fund or their charities. In a way, General Morley hated the saint and the sinner. They were hypocrites. They were cowards, unable to wear the skulls of their victims proudly on their belts like the demons of old. In a way, he envied them. They were able to fulfill their every lust with the spoils of their crimes. They were able to purchase their mortal freedom to do as they wish with the working poor, teasing them with dreams and deceiving them with propaganda, alchemically converting the greatest riches of the earth into cash like pixie dust. They never suffered through sickness or poverty or felt their heart leap again and again against their ribs in a cold sweat, wondering how they would make the next house payment. Like financial sorcerers, they strode through mortal life, throwing families off their farms, ripping companies away from their founders, and herding millions of helpless people into inner-city plantation prisons. In a way, he was just like the dark seed in the garden, put deep into the first mother. Perhaps he was only adopted into the seed of Lucifer, but at least his integrity was intact. He always followed through and did exactly what he said he was going to do. His hatred was pure and forged harder and sharper in the refiner's fire than the suicidal murderers who bludgeoned themselves in a ridiculous and endless jihad. Wes Morley was the ultimate accuser, fashioned from pure human stock by the mentor of misery and pain who raised him. He was loved by no one, not even himself. He was therefore entitled to his superiority and to the respect that he received from the most evil beings in the universe, perhaps because even they knew that eventually, given enough worlds to destroy, he would be greater than them all. He walked a path created for gods in embryo, higher than the angels, and chose to rival the master of mayhem to become the purest judge in the universe and its merciless executioner. "General, our course has been calculated for returning to Denver," said the colonel to the cabin door after gently knocking on it. The lack of response was the answer. He could not bring himself to knock again. He turned around, with no military movement on his mind, and walked vacantly back to the command section of Looking Glass, to sit down for the first time in more than a day, and stare out of the window. The colonel felt as though part of him had been beaten and left in a wet and reeking alley to die. The other part, that wore the uniform and gave the appearance of command and control, had carried his tattered soul through many battles before. He would live through this. Another war will come. Another war always comes.